Judge, the Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Catherine G. Leonard, Lawrence M. Reifert, and Lisa M. Ginoza presiding. Please be seated. Case number 30227, Leslie Dobbins v. State of Hawaii. Vaughn Winborn for appellant, Jason Skyer for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Good morning. Are you ready to proceed, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please, go ahead.
Please support. I'm Vaughn Winborn. I'm representing Leslie Dobbins, who is the appellant in this case. I'm not really sure where to start on this because this is in an order about two specific cases, as to GDO and Jerome. I'm going to back up a little bit and start with the facts in the case and the facts. I think distinguish it a little bit from Estabilio and Jerome in that in this particular case, the police, specifically Officer Brian Prudencio of the Hawaii County Police Department, gets some information. And based on that information, he leads some policemen to a specific location, blocks off this location. The location is on private property. It's not on the street. It's on a private gas station. The information he gets is that it's a there's sufficient evidence that a drug transaction would occur at a location involving a Filipino male in a gold-colored sedan. At the hearing on this, it's a gold-colored sedan or a beige-colored sedan. Then later on, there's a beige-colored sedan with no mention of a gold-colored sedan. The description of the vehicle by the confidential informant says that it's a sedan, but doesn't say whether it's a two-door or a four-door, whether it's got a hatchback or what make it or model it is. Certainly doesn't have the license plate or other identification. It doesn't say how old the vehicle is or the make of the model.
Mr. Winborn, what do we know from the record in this case about the confidential informant?
I don't believe we know much of anything about the confidential informant except that he or she is allegedly reliable.
Okay, and it's just he's reliable. I've used him before. He's reliable. It was just a representation of reliability.
I think it's a representation of reliability. Unfortunately, I'm not the trial attorney, so I'm relying on some of the evidence at the hearing.
As are we.
Yes. So the court took judicial notice there were lots of sedans in Hilo. That's obviously important because what this is not doing is narrowing the focus of this confidential informant's assertions to any one person. The main thing, the next thing is the Filipino is named Les, and the Filipino is named Les is possibly from Maui or Oahu. Now, that really doesn't help much because you can't look at someone and say they're Filipino, they're less, or they're from Maui or Oahu.
Right. Well, Mr. Winborn, when, in your view, was there a seizure or a stop in this case?
Initially, I think when the police drove up in the van, blocked the car in, that was when there was a seizure or a stop.
Was the car blocked, or was there room for the car to maneuver out? But that was subsequently blocked by the officer.
I think there's a difference of opinion on that. The people in the car didn't think they could maneuver out. And when the police got out, they certainly couldn't maneuver out without running over the police.
Well, there's some evidence or testimony about the car the car that your client was driving at the time, moving towards Officer Prudencio. Isn't that a significant fact here in terms of the seizure analysis? Or how do you address that particular factor?
there is some evidence of that. There's apparently some disagreement about that, but I think it's explained by the panic trying to put the car into gear to get the car away from the threat that's there. And we would contend that the threat is an illegal and unlawful threat.
Was the threat at that point that the car started moving was simply the blocking of the vehicle?
The blocking of the fact that these guys have guns and they're pulled out and they're pointing.
I think that's my question. Was the gun, and again, I think you're right that perhaps the record is a little unclear on this, but was the gun pulled? I've seen testimony that the gun was pulled after the car started moving. Is there, in fact, clear testimony
there
that
the gun... There is not clear testimony.
Is there clear testimony that the gun was pulled prior to the car moving? Whose testimony is it?
I don't think there is clear testimony as to exactly when the gun was pulled. Or guns were pulled because there are multiple policemen there with multiple guns. And so they would pull them out at different times, presumably. And I think it would be a common practice for police in a situation where they think there is a drug deal going on for whatever reason to go there armed and probably to pull their guns out.
Okay.
I don't know if there's any clear evidence. I think there's a difference of opinion to exactly when the guns were pulled and when which policeman pulled.
Mr. Winborn, even if we agree with your analysis on that initial seizure, that's not all that happened here, correct?
That's correct.
Why don't you go on to the, if you will, the traffic stop and the subsequent search?
After the police came, the car, the subject car, whatever color it is, whatever it looks like, backed up, and backed apparently as a, it's described as an 8-foot drop. And I looked at it myself, it seemed to be 8 feet, but it's a significant drop anyway, and was basically trapped at the bottom of this incline with some telephone poles.
Now the car in reversing, it had to go over a curb? It went over a curb and then the embankment and down the grassy area?
Yes, there's a, I'm not sure if it's actually a curb, it's an edge, it's a raised edge marking the edge of the property in the beginning of the embankment so that people on this gas station wouldn't drive over, that they would stop.
So the building, there isn't a building behind the vehicle, it's just the grassy area. Once he went over the, reversed over the edge as you refer to it, the grass was there, there was no building to
There's a building,
avoid.
I think back away from it, and there's a building sort of to the, if you're in the car, going over backwards, there's a building, I think, to the right. But I don't think he's driving to a building. He's driving...
He simply went backwards.
Backwards. Trying to flee the danger that he perceived.
So, the car hits a traffic pole, and that at that point, the officers go down to the car and extract both Mr. Dabas and another individual that's in the vehicle.
Yes.
Okay. So in terms of that, I mean, I think as Judge Leonard mentioned, even if we were to assume that the initial seizure was inappropriate, at that point, what at least the circuit court said was there was a second appropriate stop in light of the traffic infractions. I'd like you to speak to that, please, and the subsequent facts that occurred after that stop.
I think the circuit court misunderstood the circumstances. Mr. Davis's car had been forced back by his perception of the danger from the police, and that we would contend that danger was an unlawfully made danger to him. And he has a right to try and flee that danger. At least that would be our contention. And that by doing so, he does not incur traffic violations.
Now, is this because Davis did not recognize these as police officers?
Yes. That's what his assertion is.
So the
there is a difference of opinion on that, too. There apparently, this is not a The facts here are not universally accepted.
What does Dabas testify to as to what the officers were wearing, or these individuals were wearing? Does he say anything about that?
I don't believe he does say anything about that. They're wearing police uniforms. So the second quote, seizure, doesn't really occur, at least in our interpretation, because it's really part of the first one, and it's not, it's not any more valid than the first one.
So let's talk about Estabilio a little then. I mean, in your view, does Estabilio play any part in this court's analysis?
Well, I'm not sure we did not call us in Estabilio. There's the initial valid stop
that you for traffic.
For traffic. That you then have to relate the second series of activities back to, and that it seems in Estabilio that they're saying you can't do it in that case anyway. This seems to be, at least according to what has been presented today by the court, the questions, it seems to be almost the reverse, where you have an invalid initial stop, that there then may be a valid second stop, so there is no relation back problem. So I'm not sure that Estabilio is really the same as this, if you grant the hypothesis and the questions. And because of that, I think Estabilio is a good case, but I'm not sure how related it is to this particular set of facts.
But if we view it as possibly related, and our analysis includes that the police were justified in investigating Mr. Dabas, reversing over the 8-foot embankment and crashing into the utility pole, the question is whether the search thereafter was reasonably related in scope to the circumstances which justified the interference in the first place. That's one of the questions from Estabilio. And then what were the totality of circumstances that may perhaps have justified the search in that case? And whether you go back and consider the confidential informant or we don't consider that, assuming that we get to the traffic stop or the traffic search, what's the next step in the analysis?
If you get to the traffic, to investigating the car going back over and hitting the phone poles and stopping, if you don't have the valid initial stop and the evidence that is given for that is discounted or eliminated, then there's really no reason that I see that Mr. Dabas should be searched. Is a bad driver, which is not the same as being a drug carrier. And there's no reason other than once you get him out of the car to do a pat-down search, it's then to some arrest.
I think that's part of the question. Your answer assumes that we don't go back and consider the totality of the circumstances, which includes perhaps the tip, the observations of the officers when they arrived on the scene, seeing the car back up into the stall, seeing somebody from Mr. Dabas's car go over to another car in what the officer at least testified looked like a drug transaction, and then we ignore the car moving forward towards the officer, and then ultimately the reversing back down the embankment. So I think the question is, why wouldn't we consider that? I mean, isn't that the totality of the circumstances here?
I'm not sure that Estabilio considers the totality of the circumstances in that sense, because they start with the valid stop. If you start with the valid stop here and we say that the valid stop is at the bottom of the embankment, then the totality of the circumstances, which my contention would be, they begin at the stop, not at whatever reason they might be there to look, which we, of course, contend are improper.
Wasn't there some analysis about the tip in Estabilio? I mean, wasn't one of the reasons why and it was Officer Prudencio in that case as well, But one of the reasons why, the reason for the stop was he had a tip in that case as well.
He did have a tip, and he used, I think it was Officer Paoli, to pull this Mr. Estabile over. And I don't know that.
I guess my question is, in that case, didn't the court go back and at least analyze the tip? Because if we take your contention that we have to start at the proper stop, which is the traffic infraction after we've crashed into the traffic pole, then we wouldn't even consider the tip if under your suggestion, correct?
Yes. I think that my understanding is, that, or my reading of Estabilio is that it starts with the stop, which may sound funny. But
yeah, I think what Estabilio says is in that case, Officer Prudencio's statement that a confidential informant had provided him with such information was insufficient to form the basis for a reasonable suspicion. Now, it seemed like they considered it and said, okay, that alone wasn't enough to form the basis for reasonable suspicion. But then they went on to look at nervous, evasive behavior being a pertinent factor in determining reasonable suspicion. And they cite Illinois v. Wardlow for the proposition of, however, unless it's unusually severe or persistent or accompanied by other more probative grounds for reasonable suspicion, it's of limited significance. But here, I assume Mr. Skyle will argue that backing over the 8-foot embankment was a severe evasive conduct. And you're saying it's not under these circumstances because of the first illegal stop. Is that correct?
Yes. I would also emphasize that there is no description initially of who this person is going to be. There's nothing about, other than the fact that they're male and Filipino. There's nothing about their height, their weight, their body type, hair, age, things like that. And I think that is crucial here. And I think it also bears, when you read Jerome, for in Jerome there are very detailed, very descriptive indicia of who they're looking for, exactly where they're going to be, exactly what car they're going to be in, exactly what the box looks like. So I think that shows a significant difference between that probable cause, or that attempt to get probable cause, reasonable suspicion, and this.
And in Jerome, there wasn't a second stop, there was one stop.
Right. But I was struck by the difference between that 1987 case where things seemed to be very specifically laid out and this 2006 where things are much more muddy and much less specific on the part of the police. So I think that that makes, to me, a big difference in looking at the way you view reasonable suspicion of probable cause in this case, either for the first stop or for the second stop. And when you look at the totality of the circumstances, that case seems to be much, the totality of the circumstances seem to be a whole lot clearer in Jerome than they are in Davis. You would argue that they aren't clear enough in Davis to allow the stop.
You would agree that we don't take each individual factor and analyze them alone, that we take all of the circumstances together.
Actually, I wouldn't agree with that. I think you analyze each factor alone to determine how credible or reliable that factor is, and then you add them up. For example, if you had a whole bunch of irrelevant factors, they wouldn't add up to anything leading to reasonable suspicion.
Well, in the state's brief, what they argue is that if you just talk about a beige car, that's an innocent factor. If you just talk about, I think in addressing your argument, that perhaps just backing into a stall is an innocent act. Identifying a Filipino male is there's nothing, suspicious about that. But when you take all of the factors together, plus what the officer observed at the scene, that then you mix in those other factors to make the totality of the circumstances. Do you take issue with that?
not with the proposition that you could basically add them up and the sum would be greater than the parts. But in this case, we would say that even the sum is not greater than the parts because they're so vague that you add them up and you still don't get a focused indication of who you're looking for. You're better off than everyone in Hawaii, but you're not better off than all the people who might be somewhat similarly situated, who might be in a parking lot. That you don't narrow the focus to, gee, this is the guy we want to get. Like in Jerome, where I think you very clearly narrow the focus in Jerome. This is exactly who we're looking for. The only thing that apparently they don't have is a name that they have. And Jerome is very clearly focused. And so that would be where I think the difference is.
Except in this case, we do have what the state has characterized as the evasive behavior. And we do have to look at that under vestibulo if we consider it to be evasive, correct?
Yes. And I would contend that it is evasive in the sense that Mr. Davis is confronted with what he considers a violent situation with people with guns drawn approaching him. And he does wish to evade that danger. The state would say that the evasion is evading capture by law enforcement. And so I think there is a difference of opinion there, and I think it's up to the court to determine which one of those interpretations are appropriate. But I would argue maybe you don't even get there, because if there are two interpretations that are appropriate, then has the state really shown or met its burden to show that it's focused enough, even with those? We would contend no that it has.
Thank you, Mr. Bernard.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jason Skyer on behalf of the people of the county and state of Hawaii. Before I go into my prepared remarks regarding the two cases that the court wanted us to analyze, I wanted to try to address some of the court's questions and clarify some of the things that Mr. Winborn said. First of all, I think Mr. Winborn is clearly incorrect in the appropriate standard of looking at the totality of the circumstances regarding whether or not there was a reasonable suspicion for the initial attempt to contact Mr. Davis in the vehicle. I think what Mr. Winborn is trying to do is what the U.S. Supreme Court specifically said no to in Arvizu. Arvizu talks about the divide and conquer analysis, that you don't isolate each individual factor and say there's a reasonable explanation for this. You know, there's a possible legitimate explanation for that. Then really, Arvizu talks about putting together the whole ball of wax and allowing a police officer who has been trained, and Officer Prudencio, when the court reviews the transcripts from the hearing, has a lot of experience in this area. He testified that he was part of a federal investigation where they would be up on the wiretaps and they would know a drug deal was going to happen, and it was his job to go to the location and make sure the drug deal actually happened without really intervening in it. So he has witnessed, he's had a chance to personally witness a number of what they knew to be drug transactions happening. So he knows what drug transactions look like. And even though there might be a number of innocent factors going on that might on their own be explainable away, at that point, based on his training and experience and under Arvizu, that's really the appropriate standard to look at is the entire ball.
So looking just at that issue, what happened here that is a drug transaction? I mean, backing into a parking spot isn't a drug transaction. Talking to somebody in another car in and of itself isn't a drug transaction. Was there something exchanged? What were the indicia of a drug transaction?
The main indicia of the drug transaction was the person getting out of not only Mr. Davis. I mean, there's kind of two factors to look at here. Number one is the size of the area and the matching of the information that he had from the informant to what was actually going on. We're not talking about a parking lot like at Alamoana Mall where there's hundreds of cars being parked. There's a number of pictures that were entered into the record, and I encourage the court to look at that, about the size of the parking lot. I think there's maybe, I'm going off my memory, maybe 15, maximum 20 stalls, but probably closer to 15 stalls in the parking lot. There's nobody else in the parking lot that even comes close to the description that Officer Prudencio had as far as the color of the vehicle, you know, the Filipino male, everything kind of falling into place like that. And I think what kind of put Officer Prudencio over the edge of this is the point where I need to effectuate or try to effectuate that Terry stop is when the passenger got out of Mr. Davis's vehicle and walked over to the other vehicle. At that point, that was familiar to him with how drug transactions are normally conducted. And so at that point, when the passenger from Mr. Davis's vehicle was approaching the other vehicle, at that point, he felt it necessary to try to effectuate the Terry stop. And
Mr. Sorry, real quick. Let's stop and go back, though. The tip that led them to get to that location, which was a like Pizza Hut, right? Shell Pizza Hut, with 15 or 20 stalls there. What led them to that location was a tip, right? And I know that Officer Prudencio testified that it was a reliable informant. What testimony is there as to the reliability of this informant?
There's very little testimony because what the state was relying on at the hearing was the search warrant in support of ultimately searching Mr. Davis's vehicle, because there was no search of the vehicle done before the search warrant, before the judge signed the search warrant. In Estabilio, when the court reviewed the search warrant from that particular case, there was no information establishing the reliability of the content of the informant that provided Officer Prudencio with the information. That's completely opposite here in this particular case. I would encourage the court to look at the record and look at the search warrant that was entered in evidence. And I think when the court does that, the reliability of the confidential informant and based on the information that's in the search warrant will clearly pass the Aguilar-Spinelli test as far as being a reliable person that they could rely on as far as the information for Mr. Davis ultimately being in the parking lot in the drug transaction.
Well, it's interesting because a search warrant obviously wasn't issued until after all of the activity and the car reversing into the traffic pole. And at which point then the car was taken to the police station and searched, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So if we're talking about the going back to the initial stop then, that doesn't help.
I think the reliability of the informant is not something that happened in between the time that Mr. Davis crashed his vehicle and when the search was ultimately conducted. I think the reliability of the informant and the warrant predates all of this. And so, I don't know.
So you're saying the warrant includes details about the reliability of the confidential informant?
Correct. And like I said, I think I encourage the court to review it, but I think it'll pass the Aguilar-Spinelli test as far as the number of previous times that police had relied upon this particular informant for information that ultimately led to either controlled purchases or drug arrests and drug convictions. And so I think that's a huge area where this particular case is different than the Estabilio case. But also, like I said, going back to the initial parking lot, initial attempt of Officer Prudencio to try to approach the vehicle, defense tries to make a big deal about the distinction between gold versus beige. And I know when the court has reviewed the record of this case, there's a bunch of paint swatches that were entered into evidence. And the court was probably wondering, you know, why was all this done? And I think Officer Prudencio had a very clear explanation of the difference in his mind between gold versus beige. He described it as the difference to him between gray and silver, that to him it was an identical color, but gold was a glossy finish, beige was a matte finish. And I think when the court reviews the record from the actual suppression hearing, I think all the paint swatches that were given to Officer Prudencio were matte finish. And I think ultimately he testified to the public defender, you know, had you chosen glossy finish for some of these colors, I would have said gold versus beige. So I think the distinction between gold versus beige is really kind of a non-issue. And so I think in that respect, the Jerome case is really helpful to the state here, because Jerome ultimately found that it was probable cause based on the information that the officers had in Jerome, whereas all that Officer Prudencio really needed to try to approach the defendant's vehicle in the first place is a much more standard under Terry. It's the reasonable suspicion standard. And so I think even with the details that Mr. Winborn tries to point out that were present in Jerome and that were not present in In this particular case, like I said, it's a much lower standard that Officer Prudencio needed to just initially try to approach the vehicle and, as Terry says, as quickly as possible to confirm or dispel your suspicions, walk up to the vehicle and basically say, is your name Les? And if he says no, then at that point the Terry stop is over.
Your argument is that the initial stop was appropriate.
Correct.
And after that, everything else, there's no question if the initial stop is appropriate because
correct.
Of the actions of Mr. Dobbs in reversing the vehicle. And ultimately
can, yeah. And one thing that I read, the initial facts that led up to Mr. Dobbs ultimately putting the car in drive, almost running over the police officer, then putting the car in reverse and going down the embankment and crashing. There's a specific finding of fact from the circuit court. It's finding of fact number 8 that talks about how the vehicle was in motion before Officer Prudencio drew down his gun on Mr. Dobbs. And I think that's critically important for the court to look at, that this is not, it's a finding of fact, this is not something to be reviewed de novo on appeal. The circuit court is really bound with the appeals court is really bound with the circuit court's finding of fact under the clearly erroneous standard, and I don't think Mr. Dobbs even attempts to say that that finding of fact is clearly erroneous. So that's the circuit court had the opportunity to actually look at the witnesses and hear the witnesses testify, and that was the ultimate finding of fact. So ultimately, you've got Mr. Dobbs as basically somebody who's in, who's identified as a police officer walking up to his vehicle. And under his theory of the facts, merely walking in front of his vehicle is a temporary seizure of his vehicle. And if that's the case, every time I go to Walmart, I seize every vehicle in the parking lot as I'm walking by.
There's more than that, though. I mean, the van at least partially blocks. Mr. Dobbs's car, which is reversed into the stall, correct?
Correct. But I think the finding of fact ultimately talks about he was able to, had Officer Prudencio not been standing in the exact spot that he was standing, he would have been able to leave. I think even if Mr. Dobbs had waited a second or two for Officer Prudencio to go around the vehicle because he was trying to approach the driver's side, at that point it would have been clear he would have been able to drive right out.
So your argument is that Mr. Dobbs was free to leave?
Mr. Dobbs, at that point, really, in his mind, there's two things. Either he felt he was free to leave, and he tried to do so.
Objectively, would a reasonable person believe that Dobbs was free to leave with the police van blocking, even under your facts, police van pops in front of him, 6 guys jump out wearing SWAT suits, and whether they have the guns drawn before and afterwards, you're saying Dobbs would have felt free to leave?
I think Mr. Dobbs is even incorrect in arguing that. I think if the circuit court reviews the record, the testimony was that Officer Prudencio was really the only person out of the van until the car went in reverse and went down the embankment. At that point, the rest of the people in the van unloaded. So at this point, you have basically one person that's walking around this van and kind of walking around the front of Mr. Dobbs's vehicle trying to get towards the driver's side. So I don't think it's a huge show of force at that point. And like I said, the finding of fact specifically says he did not have his gun drawn. There was no use of force or use of a dangerous weapon like that until Mr. Dobbs chose to put his car in drive and then ultimately put his car in reverse.
Was there any emblem on the van at all?
No, there's no testimony. It's a
nondescript 8-passenger van.
It was a white panel van, I think is what they said. But ultimately, like I was saying before, looking at it from Mr. Dobbs' perspective, there's really only two possible options. The first possible option is he felt he was free to leave and he tried to act on that. And he just chose the wrong time to do it because Officer Prudencio happened to be kind of walking in front of his vehicle at that point. Or Mr. Dobbs knew that it was police and he intentionally tried to flee from the police. I think either one of those ultimate conclusions is not really beneficial to Mr. Dobbs' case. And then ultimately what happens is Mr. Dobbs chooses to throw his car in reverse. And I think the characterization of the embankment as 8 feet mischaracterizes the evidence. Officer Prudencio testified on 2 days. The first day he testified, he talks about the embankment being 20 to 30 feet. And there were pictures of the embankment that were entered into evidence. And I encourage the court to look at those. I think the testimony in the second day was about a drop. And I think, to try to clarify this, I think when the court looks at the embankment, part of it's grassy and part of it there's rocks sticking out. I think Officer Prudencio was referring to once he went over the rocks, it was a sheer straight drop down of about 8 feet that was contained in that otherwise 20 to 30 foot embankment. But ultimately, the direction that Mr. Dobbs' car was careening towards was number 1, a public street, and then across the street, there was a school gym in the parking lot of a school gym. And so ultimately the fatal flaw in Mr. Davis' argument is, assuming for the sake of argument, there's some sort of illegal attempt to seize on behalf of police, and that basically that's arises to somebody shouting, "Ollie, Ollie, oxen free." He's able to flee the scene at that point of whatever, you know, instead of colliding with a pole, had he collided with a child or had he collided with, you know, a car on the street, that he would be able to evade liability for that. And I think the Sledge case, and I think all the other cases talk about is that as a cause that, assuming for the sake of argument, there's some sort of initial illegality there, that that's enough of an intervening cause to sever the taint of any initial illegality.
Well, of course, Mr. Winborn's argument is that there it's all one event. I mean, there isn't a break in the action here, that the actions of Mr. Davis are a direct result of the conduct of the officers, and therefore we shouldn't consider really the separate actions. But let me ask you this. If, in fact, this court were to determine, as the circuit court did, that the initial seizure was illegal, and we have, as the circuit court found, that concluded that there was a second stop based on traffic infraction, the search went beyond just for a traffic infraction. So, and so I'd like you to address Escobillo directly as to that point.
Okay, a couple points I wanted to clarify. First of all, I would argue that there was no initial seizure at the top of the parking lot. There might have been an attempt to seize, but ultimately Mr. Dow was based on his own actions. He was never ultimately seized until he did that himself by colliding into the tree.
Well, the circuit court concluded that the drawing of the gun was a seizure.
Correct.
So let's assume that's correct.
Okay.
And go from there.
Okay, this case is different from Escobillo in a number of ways. Once defendant's car careens down the embankment, it ultimately collides in the pole, because when you look at the initial justification for the stop in Escobillo, it's a speeding infraction, which is technically a civil violation, which did not subject Mr. Escobillo to arrest. Whereas when you look at the situation here, the offenses, he can either be charged with reckless driving and intention to driving. There are a number of different traffic offenses that are all either misdemeanors or petty misdemeanors that would potentially subject Mr. Davis to arrest after police see that with their own eyes happening. So I think that clearly distinguishes the situation from Escobillo. I think the other thing that distinguishes the situation here from Escobillo is the damage done to Mr. Davis's vehicle rendered that vehicle incapable of being moved from the scene. Basically, I think Officer Prudencio testified, I forgot if it was at the suppression or trial, that once the vehicle collided with the pole, the back wheels were off the ground, and he heard the engine revving and the wheels spinning. So ultimately, at that point, the vehicle is immobilized there. It's jammed itself up against the tree. There's no way, absent somebody bringing in a tow truck or some sort of piece of heavy machinery, for the vehicle to get out of there.
They had to break the window to extract Mr. Davis and the individual in the car.
The police officers, after Mr. Davis kind of jams himself up on the pole, they see him jump into the back seat, and they see him sitting on a bag kind of messing with something, and they think that either he's going for a weapon or that he's trying to destroy evidence at that point. So one of the police officers chose to breach the, because it was tinted windows in the back, to breach the tinted window and ultimately pull Mr. Davis out of the vehicle. Because after they chased the vehicle down the embankment, they gave a number of commands to Mr. Davis to stop the vehicle, get out of the vehicle. He chose to ignore all of those and jump in the back seat.
And at what point was the canine brought in to do the drug sniff?
Almost immediately. I think that's another thing that distinguishes this case from the Jerome case, is that in Jerome they talk about the canine took about a half hour to get there. In this case, there was testimony that the narcotic detection canine was already in the police van that was up at the top of the hill. So I think it was a matter of seconds, maybe a minute or two before the dog was available to screen Mr. Davis.
So again, if you assume the initial stop was illegal, and that the basis, as the circuit court determined, the basis for the second stop, the appropriate basis for the second stop is a traffic infraction or these, the way that he operated his vehicle. Under Escobillo, don't we need specific, independent, articulable facts to then get to a separate drug investigation to bring the canine out?
And I think, like I said before, that this case is distinguishable from Escobillo because when the court looks at the warrant again, Escobillo, there was no information, or the informant there could not satisfy the Aguilar-Spinelli test. I think here that's a a huge distinguishing factor in that. And I think under Arvizu, when the court puts the whole ball of wax together, and I think flight from justice is one of the factors that the court can look at in whether or not there's probable cause, reasonable suspicion. I think what happened at the top end of the parking lot combined with Mr. Davis's attempt to flee from justice, I think at that point clearly there's enough reasonable suspicion to initiate a drug investigation. And also I wanted to clarify too, in a footnote, that the public defender, I argued a stability. So in arguing a stability, the public defender was encouraging, was trying to get the Supreme Court to overturn Snitkin and to overturn Groves and to impose some sort of probable cause, reasonable suspicion standard before a canine, narcotic detection canine screen could be done. The Court of Estabilia specifically refused to do that. And so Snitkin and Groves are still good law here in Hawaii. So I don't think there's any necessity for probable cause, reasonable suspicion for the police to go through the mere act of running the narcotic detection canine. I think the only thing that happened other than that was Officer Prudencio asked Davis for consent to search. Davis ultimately said no, so I don't really see there's any prejudice to Mr. I think Mr. Davis would probably have a much stronger case had he consented to the search, and we could now go back and say there wasn't probable, or it wasn't even reasonable suspicion to ask me that question. But ultimately, his answer to the question was no, in which case the canine screen was almost immediately done. And at that point, I think all federal and state law says once the narcotic detection canine alerts to the vehicle, at that point, there's probable cause to
arrest. It's the question of bringing the canine in at this juncture that I'm focused on. I mean, ultimately, what you're saying is the reliability of the informant is the significant factor, both as to the first stop as well as the second stop. But that's essentially the crux of your argument.
Correct. I think that was the major shortfalling in Estabilio, is that I was actually the trial attorney that did Estabilio, and I kind of made a tactical decision to focus more on Barros and what the Intermediate Court of Appeals have agreed with in Estabilio regarding the amount of time of the detention rather than establishing separate reasonable suspicion to come in and conduct the drug investigation. Whereas here, this is completely different. Like I said, in the warrant, in this particular case, I think there's more than enough to satisfy Aguilar Spinelli and completely take this case out of the realm of Estabilio. So ultimately, I think even if the court agrees with the circuit court's determination that the initial attempt to seize Mr. Davis was unlawful, I think the fact that it was his decision to throw the car in reverse and go down the embankment and the ultimate traffic collision, I think under State versus the cases that are cited in the conclusions of law, Sledge, U.S. versus Sledge, U.S. versus Bailey, and State versus Nelson, that at that point it presents an intervening factor that severed any poison from the initial tree. I think if the court goes and looks on Westlaw for any cases that disagree with Sledge, with those three cases, I think the only cases that I was able to find that disagree with those are in states where people still have the common law right of resisting an illegal arrest. I think here in Hawaii, our statutes have clearly done away with that, and the case law has clearly done away with that. So in Hawaii, because you do not have the former common law right to resist an illegal arrest anymore, that at that point, Mr. Estabilio stuck with his actions, and he stuck with what he did, that jammed his vehicle up on the tree and rendered him immobilized at that point. Also, even if it were able to be moved, Mr. Davis did not have a valid driver's license. There's no testimony anywhere in the record that anybody else at the scene had permission to, or was actually legally able to move the vehicle from where it was, even if it was able to be moved. So, and that's also in contrast to Estabilio, because he was never cited for not having a driver's license. So I think ultimately Estabilio, had the encounter ended sooner, you know, he had the lawful ability to drive his vehicle, and the vehicle is still in operable condition to drive out of there. Whereas here, obviously, number one, the vehicle is not in operable condition. Number two, Mr. Davis, to let Mr. Davis back in the vehicle, I think continue to commit an ongoing crime. And so that's really the end of my prepared remarks, unless the justice has any more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your time, and I thank you for allowing me on in this case.
Mr. Winburne.
Thank you. There are a couple of
taking our time on this, and there are a couple of issues that I'd like to talk about. One is state talks about a flight from justice as a basis for why the police can bring a dog and go into and basically break them and then take Mr. Davis out of the vehicle. We would contend that there isn't a flight from justice. The flight is from injustice. That doesn't give them the right, them being the state, the right to go in and take these actions. I was struck, what if there hadn't been, these rocks? What if there hadn't been the light bulb? What if Mr. Davies had, been able to get the car to the bottom and just drive off onto the street? What would his violation be? What would his traffic violation be? He drove over a piece of private property and pulled onto the road and drove away, assuming there's nothing else there. Now, I understand that's hypothetical and that may not lead anywhere, but it occurs to me that maybe that's an important consideration, that the police don't just get to sort of bootstrap their way into someone's car. And I think it's very important that this is on private property. It's not on public property. It's not. There's nothing that I am aware of in this case that says there is a specific danger presented to the public. There is a possible danger if Mr. Davis's car streaks across the street and runs into somebody and does all this other stuff. But that's no better than any other situation where someone is driving a car. Yes, they could drive in front of other people. They could run down people at a bus stop, stuff like that. But there's nothing here that says that's bound to happen.
Mr. Winburn, would you please address Mr. Skyer's assertion that the search warrant will take care of any reliability issues for the informant that was relied upon to send the officers to this location in the first place?
Well, I think the court focused on an interesting point, which was that the search warrant was afterward, and it does clarify what was apparently going on in Officer Pertencio's mind. But I don't think, I go back to what did the confidential informant tell him? He didn't tell him much. I mean, it's not like the confidential informant in Jerome, where the confidential informant lays it out for him. And in this, the confidential informant may be reliable in the sense that he doesn't just out and out lie about things, but he's not particularly helpful in determining what is going to happen or what's going to go on. And so he may be, I'm not sure what reliability means to Officer Prudencio, and I think that that goes back to the color of the car. And I think that is not unimportant. The reason I would contend that it's important is that if Officer Prudencio doesn't know what the color of the car means, when he is told this, how can he possibly use that to focus on this car? And I think that goes back to reliability. When Prudencio doesn't know what the informant is telling him, if that's not firm in his mind, then I don't think that makes it a good indicia of how to focus the investigation that he's trying to go and how to get reasonable suspicion.
His testimony essentially at the suppression hearing was beige and gold is basically the same color to him. Right. That's essentially what he testified.
And that is what he testified to, and I think there was somewhere it mentioned tan. But those all look, they're not like orange and blue. I mean, they are somewhat related colors. But if you're told that, this is what it is, and you understand this is what it might be, then it's not sure enough. You're not able to get accurate information because you can't rely on, this is what the color actually is. well, this is what it might be, and this is what it might be. And as all of us know, when you ride down the road, you see cars that are every imaginable shade of color. And so you have to, in order to say this is this car, I mean, it'd be helpful to have four doors. There are a lot of things that would be helpful that, you know, sort of a whole lot simpler to clarify than what the color is. You know, it could be tan, it could be beige, it could be gold, it could be some kind of a green color. I mean, you know, we've all seen those colors on cars, and they look sort of close to the same, but four doors, two doors, hatchbacks, you know, those look very different. And those, I mean, just that illustration is the kind of thing that would make a huge difference in this case and make it much more like the Jerome case where, yeah, we know exactly what they're talking about. And in this case, because we don't know what they're talking about, we can't really form a reasonable suspicion for the probable cause that would be needed. It's interesting that there's no right to resist an illegal arrest, but my understanding is that the state has never claimed that there was an arrest. And so, if there isn't an arrest, then Mr. Davis would be free to leave. And if he's free to leave, then there is no problem with him backing the car up. The problem is that he's not a good driver, or that he, you know, drives over rocks that are way too big for his car to go over. Has nothing to do with being a drug dealer or having drugs or having anything to do with drugs, which is the only conceivable. I mean, you don't have to have a dog come and sniff a car to determine that there might be a traffic violation. And the state has proposed that this second traffic stop is all that's needed, given the other circumstances, to have this dog here. And we would contend that that's simply not the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement.
All right.
Court is now in recess.
Is it cool? Sorry,